You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the Radio Maria studio here in Toronto, talking today on a nice frosty day of January 2019, discussing what we usually emphasize every month, that is the themes of immigration and citizenship here in Canada. Because our program on immigration and citizenship in English is about once a month, and because immigration and citizenship matters are such hot-button items, there's always so much to talk about in such a short period of time. Although we will try this year, of course, to also have other themes as we have other year in other areas of the law and of interest to all of our listeners. And, of course, we need to remind you that that a lot of the programs right now are being taped and available by podcast on the Radio Maria website, if you're listening to us otherwise, or you have people who know can't necessarily be available on Saturday mornings to listen to us. We do take questions and or comments that people would like to make. And, of course, in English, the phone number is 416-245-1534. I would repeat it just for interest's sake. Area code 416, which is the Toronto area. And the phone number is 254-1534. So as I mentioned, we're going to be discussing immigration and citizenship. There are a lot of matters to discuss. And I wanted to point out for our listeners in English in particular, because there are a couple of matters that I think are really, really important that people just have to be aware of because it's the end of January. And it may interest people because of all of a lot of our listeners, people would say, well, who listens to Radio Maria? Well, the demographic very often can, of course, be younger people who have recently immigrated. Sometimes it's older people who have a little bit more time on their hand or have other interests in listening to the radio broadcast. But there's a program of immigration. If we look at immigration, as we know, there's the economic and the non-economic aspects of immigration that have certain categories. And we've discussed at length, but it was recently announced the past month that basically we're going to already meet next year 350,000 to 360,000 people a year coming in. And the very thing that we have talked about, that the magic number is almost 1% of the Canadian population coming to Canada in immigration, because the demographics are that we don't have the magic number of 2.2 to replace ourselves per woman who has children. And so because of that, we have a shortfall, a demographic shortfall, as Canada moves from 35 to 36 million to 50 to 60 million, probably within the next 20 years. So in the next 20 years, we're going to have at least 350,000 people a year coming to Canada. And as we've always said, Canada chooses in large part the people who come to this country. You know, there's a lot of, I call it cheap talk or trash talk, you know, or coffee shop talk. A lot of it is absolute garbage and nonsense. People, unfortunately, it's human nature. We all have our biases and our thoughts about things, and we tend to generalize from a particular incident that we see as opposed to a larger demographic. But the truth is that 350,000 people for sure are not going to come to Canada. Most of them, over 50% of them, are in the economic category. And the what I would call the non-economic class, one of the most important ones, of course, are things like spousal sponsorships and also parental and grandparent sponsorships, because Canada, in that respect, is still fairly generous in, with respect to the uniting of families or people who come to this country. And a lot of the younger people who are coming, of course, are people who probably already have a good job. We've discussed work permits in the past and people move through the express entry system. So we have a lot of people who are either working or have a good job who've already been here in Canada and they've decided to stay. That's a principal focus of economic immigration relating to people who qualify. It's not the only one, but it's the major thrust. And so what happens is sometimes, and depending on the families, they would also like to have their parents and grandparents come, depending on how extended and united, I guess, really are their families in different parts of the world. And this has actually always been occurring in Canada, you know, we'll say for the last 100 years in terms of the immigration policy. So a part of that policy is what we would call, that's non-economic, we would call parental and grandparents. Now, people describe the policy as a non-economic program, but the probably the reality is a little bit different because in the old days when maybe Canada didn't have the rigorous criteria that they have now for the selection of immigrants, you had people who would arrive in Canada and maybe, you know, we'll use the Italian community as an example that I'm most familiar with. From a practical point of view, you had people like my father immigrated. They were skilled trades. My father was a trazo mechanic, my mom was a tailor, and in those days it wasn't our situation. But you can imagine if you were a couple coming to Canada and you had children or young children, and you actually wanted to, maybe you had some people from your part of your country or for part of Italy, for example, or friends, or we call them paisani, and you wanted to have them. Perhaps come, what would you do? And you would do what we would call a parental or grandparent sponsorship. And there are different people. And in those days, it used to happen. And it was actually, oftentimes, it was actually it was quasi-economic. It wasn't just that, they loved their parents so much, they wanted to have them come to Canada. Sometimes it was also a very practical situation. Maybe the parents were already retired although a lot of people think it's nicer to live in Italy than it is in Canada, they would still want to come to Canada because maybe there would be grandchildren. And at the same time, they could help them in terms of babysitting. So the program for this year is going to be 20,000. That's gone up. Some of you may have heard that in the past I said there were 10,000. It's now 20,000, and they've also changed the system. It used to be like the lottery, you know, and we had clients, we'd help them make sure they got into the lottery, and then people got picked, and, we had clients for 3 or 4 years that didn't get picked, and all of a sudden they got picked, because, you know, when you have 300,000-plus people come every year to Canada, you can understand that there's going to be some of them who are going to want to perhaps do an application for their parents and grandparents, who want to come to Canada, okay? I mean, you obviously have to have an intention to come here. It's not like, it's just an option, and whatever. There's all kinds of rules to maintain your residency. So people would come here, and so the numbers now have increased. From 300,000 a few years ago, 5 years ago, to now about 350, they've also increased the number to 20,000. But they've gone away from the lottery system. It seems like, although I like the lottery system because, let's say it was transparent and it was fair, there are a lot of people saying, we should be able to, there should be a different system. It shouldn't just be like a hit and miss proposition. So the government has wiffle-waffled on this, and it's always been a bone of contention with people. And they've now gone back basically to applying. So, for example, we have a number of clients before the end of this month who have to basically try to get in the lineup by the end of the month, and we're preparing them, or they're going online, because everything in this way is to be done online, that goes online. And that's starting, actually, January the 28th. So January 28th is the magic date. I know we're very close by, but if somebody really has an interest, they have to do something, because in my opinion, the 20,000 invitations will be scooped up fairly quickly. And so it's very important for any of our listeners who are in that situation to try to consider accessing that program if they have parents and grandparents who are interested in coming to live in Canada. So, and also this past week, we had, continuing along this sort of theme, Canada still remains a very popular destination point. And of course, the newspaper articles, I think, was published in Bloomberg, but a fairly leading international publication that determined that Canada was the third best place in the world to live. I don't know, number one might have been Switzerland, number two Finland or something. But anyways, and they had a whole series of factors that relate to security, being able to do business, personal security, levels of education, quality of education and healthcare. Of course, we here in Canada, we all like any good Canadian that we are, is we like to complain about everything we have. But the reality is there's an objective level. And this study, again, as many studies have in the past, placed Canada in a very very highly desirable location. So it makes sense that somebody who comes, let's say, from Mexico, and let's say they're an electrician, I'll just use that as an example, and they come here with their family, they decide that maybe they want to bring mom and dad from Guadalajara and have them come up, and Mexico is very accessible. So it's something to think about. And the other thing that got published very, very recently, also this past week, was that that Canada was ranked among the world's top democracies in the world. And people might think, well, what does that mean to be ranked as democracy? And I think the only thing that we have to realize is basically how fortunate we are when you see, for example, what is happening in Venezuela right now, the tremendous social upheaval that is existing down there. And they say there's like over 3 million refugees or potential refugees out of Venezuela who've gone into Colombia, for example. And it's a great humanitarian disaster really happening. And of course, there's always the politics in the background of the situation. So people look to Canada, and they have in my 40 years of practice, they've always looked to Canada as a highly desirable location, also because of what is fairly transparent and well-functioning democracy. So this democracy index that was done by the Economist Intelligence Unit ranked Canada actually number 10 out of 10 for civil liberties, and it was ranked sixth overall of the 167 countries that were there. It also classified Canada as a full democracy. That means in all terms and all aspects of democracy, which are the electoral process and pluralism, civil liberties, the functioning of government, political participation, and political culture, it's only one of 20 countries in the world to achieve that title. And it's important to understand that this is all underpinned by a legal system that works. And this is the difference, because the legal system reflects what's in the society. It's not just, it's a bunch of laws and they sit there and, you know, police officers and lawyers and judges and everyone just sort of, you know, repeat the laws. There's this dialectic interaction between people who live here and people who govern and the bureaucracy that tries to implement the laws. And this whole process of democracy is something that cannot be underrated, and we take it for granted. Because, for example, if some of us have come from countries like Western Europe, we would just think it's sort of more of the same, or from the United States. But there are a lot of countries in the world where a lot of people have come from that that's not the case, that democracies do not work well. And so this is another reason why it is what it is. And in fact, most, from a, even on an economic basis, those tend to be the most successful and maybe so-called richer societies that provide a better quality of life. So that's in the context of what's occurring. That's what Canada is, and it's consistently rated in that way. So it's not surprising in a country like ours that with what I've indicated, that what's going to be happening now is this year there's going to be an election in Canada, and of course, immigration is going to be a hot button item. Just yesterday, we can see in the United States that this dialogue and this discussion that goes on with immigration and eventually citizenship is being again debated and is a point of great conflict in the United States. Those of you who may have realized that the U.S. government essentially shut down for a month because the president of the United States, Trump, who had promised during his electoral campaign that he was going to create the Great Wall of Mexico at the cost of the Mexican taxpayer, wanted to have money appropriated from the resources of the U.S. government to build this law, or build a wall, or build a larger part of it. And then what occurred from a legal perspective, because every functioning democracy has checks and balances. So the president has all powers, but they're not completely one way. There are checks and balances. So, for example, in the American system, the Congress has to pass all money bills. The president has to sign off. So there's always, again, this negotiating, this compromise, this dialectic between that and the House of the Congress and the U.S. Senate. And we see all this play out because the Republican Party feels, and it seems to be a very strongly held conviction of people who belong to it, that this wall is of great importance. On the other hand, we have the Democratic Party that says if we're going to spend $5 or $6 billion, that's a stupid way for border security. And yes, it's true that we have fences and some border walls already, maybe along one third of the border with Mexico, and maybe one third is a natural border between mountains and rivers. But it's a stupid way because today we use a lot of technology and there's a lot of ways to perhaps control these issues, and it's a better use of money. And a wall is just highly maybe symbolic. So it makes me think. And these are the discussions, and in case you think it's just an American thing or I'm being anti-American, I'm not. I mean, and of course, as the poet Robert Frost said in his very famous poem, good fences make good neighbors, that you create these fences and nothing happens. But of course, we all know that in the technological world that we have today, maybe those kinds of simplistic solutions are not necessarily the best. Maybe we need more solutions relating to the smuggling of arms and guns through detector systems on maybe all vehicles. Maybe that's a discussion that we have to have, that although it's a pain in the rear end to have your car stopped every time you go between Canada and the U.S. and vice versa, or in the Mexican-Canadian border, but maybe the vehicles have to be scanned and checked to make sure that we try to limit drugs and arms that come across. Why? Because this discussion relating this has stated that the problem is actually not people crossing the border with all these kinds of illegal substances or arms. It's that I think the statistical analysis is like over 90% of illegal guns and drugs come in through ports of entry, come in through ordinary vehicles, trucks, planes, you name it. And so that's the discussion that's going on in the United States, which froze government employees for like almost a month. And it was a great humanitarian problem because people were being forced to work but not be paid. So here we have a situation where we see democracy at work, where somebody wants to do this and somebody doesn't want to do that, and there's this trade-off. It's not like what we see, for example, and I'm not against Venezuela per se, but we've seen in Venezuela a system that was somewhat democratic become a dictatorship, and it went from Prime Minister Chavez to Maduro. And now we have this huge conflict where hundreds of thousands of people are marching in the streets and the army is there. And you can just imagine the chaos and everything that goes on. So we really have to be very grateful. We really have to, in a way, thank God that we live in a country where we do not take those kinds of positions to such an extreme that we cannot talk, try to come to some solutions and try to share maybe solutions and create and implement solutions that are a little bit more balanced. And so that is the background to our immigration and citizenship system, which is sustained and supported by a legal system that, as I said, brings in 350,000 people a year, the vast majority of whom are chosen by Canada, and for whom people who have criminal conduct in particular do not get in very easily. There might be people who have had small run-ins with crime, but not major crime. And so it's very rare a case that that actually happens. And notwithstanding all of that and notwithstanding the checks and the balances that we have in Canada, we see that immigration and citizenship is going to be another hot-button item for the upcoming federal election. And so these things that we discussed with our listeners and we tried to propose to our listeners of Radio Maria, it's in the context of that that we tried to provide a little bit of perspective, because people very often can have very opposing points of view. There are some people, and traditionally on the left, and maybe who feel that we should have a more open border policy, that there should be many more refugees, and that that we should resort to a system that maybe is a little bit more typical of what happened in the United States over 100 years ago, where there was a large demand, and that's a good thing. And on the other hand, if we go to the far on the right-hand side, people feel that, no, we shouldn't let anybody in like this, that we should choose everybody they want to come. We shouldn't let any parents or grandparents come because they're all old people, older people, and they will have an impact on our healthcare system for which our scarce resources will be used. So this is the great discussion that goes back and forth, that gets underpinned, and it's going to be discussed in the next election. And all of you should be aware of it, because there will be this great discussion about all these, swarms of people arriving as refugees. Once again, there's an urban myth that there are these swarms of people that come to Canada, and that's just an objective number game. It doesn't make any difference if you are more or less inclined to more or less, for example, refugee populations. And which is a humanitarian aspect, largely, in terms of our immigration law. They're usually no more than about 30,000. And so this is something that I always say you have to call out. Where I have coffee, I call them, unfortunately, stupid, or let's all be a little bit too direct, but I'll call them less informed, let's say, or misinformed people who say quite silly things. And they don't really realize it, but that is the legal situation. That is actually the political situation. They work tandem together. A colleague of mine, Richard Kurland, this month has published an article, which I can't remember what American publication it was in, but in Canada the headline is "In Canada We Choose Skin Over Skin Color. You Should Try It, America." It was his opinion piece. Richard's a very well-known writer of all things immigration. He has a blog and a newsletter, and he's written this article because it just puts into contrast, or maybe not contrast, but into a clear light about how our system in Canada works. And once again, it's to try to dispel this myth of who comes to Canada. They are not the great unwashed, with the greatest respect to people who, may be refugees and have come to Canada with not very much. They're really not the great unwashed. Canada has changed the way it has done business. It's been a gradual process 4 years ago, there were major changes, and the scales of justice became tilted to give people who have immigration status to people who are legally here. So the people who come here to go to school, even as foreign students, we sort of want them to stay because they're sort of used to staying here and they're well qualified, and they usually speak English and French very well. And so they get these invitations to apply that we mentioned under the express entry system, and which allows them to work. And then once they're here working for a year, they become eligible, not automatically eligible, to apply for immigration. And if they hit the right point total, we give them landed immigrant status. And so it's a quid pro quo, or an exchange of what we value in people and what they value in this country, that they actually choose to be here. And they're not strangers. Most of the people that now under our new system have been here for a long time. And of course, there's other cost savings. And this is what people don't realize, that people who've been here for a long time going to school, when they come to Canada, they don't have to shell out a lot of money for language programs or public assistance or career training or unemployment costs, which, you know, it's a usual process of integration in many countries. As we see in Italy, this is always the great discussion. How much money do we have to spend to integrate these people in order that they can learn Italian so that they can integrate themselves into Italian society? You can use Italian. You can change it with any other country in the world. So Canada is a little bit special in this way, and it's been going on for years. And as Richard Kurland points out in his article, there's all kinds of checks and balances. Once again, people think, oh, anybody can come into this country. It's not true. There's third-party verification companies that independently assess language and educational credentials. It's not you or I. And this was a big change 30 years ago. You know, as lawyers, we used to make these equivalencies, and certain immigration officers understood it and others didn't. But today, there's third-party verification, just like there is doctors. They're doctors who actually have to follow a very strict guideline about healthcare and who comes to this country. I mean, I've had many a times where I've had people say, you know, I want to sponsor my father to come to Canada because he's got cancer. It's not, it's a sad story, but somebody who's got a severe form of cancer who wants to come to Canada is probably not going to be admitted, even if there's an expression of interest from the son or daughter, or even if there was, in the old systems, a lottery, because, once again, we have controls in the system. Now, that has been another big change that has just started in terms of the dollar figures that are used to assess the impact on medical and social assistance here in Canada. It used to be much more stringent and lower, but there was this magic number. It was the average money that would be spent on an average Canadian over a 5-year to 10-year period. And the magic number was roughly, you know, where you got kicked out of the lineup, as I called it, to go into Canada, was around $6,000 to $7,000. That's been the figure. But that Canada has shown an extreme generosity recently. And some cynics would say that's because there's an election, Mr. Martinello, coming up next year. And, you know, all the people who newly arrived in Canada, they want them all to vote, in this case, Liberal. So they're going to suddenly decided to become generous. One wants to be cynical. One can say that. But I can tell you that as lawyers who've been practicing through both the Conservative and Liberal administrations, it's been an ongoing discussion if that so-called magic dollar figure, how it's applied, and if it is indeed too high or too low. There are different points of view, of course, but the government has decided to switch from 6,000 to 7,000 medium annual figure to about 21,000. And there are people who will say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, that's way too generous. But what a lot of people don't know, is there are a lot of people who fell in between there, and there are a lot of court cases that went to courts where the judges said that the officers were not deciding cases on medical refusals on a proper basis. And, you know, they're highly technical arguments. But the lifting of that ceiling from the 7,000 to 21,000 has let a lot of people come in. There have been many cases of people who come to Canada, perhaps as work permits or whatever, or intercompany transferees from multinational companies that, quite frankly, earn a fair bit of money. And they come here, and maybe they end up liking being in Canada, notwithstanding the frigid weather we have here, and they want to sit here, and then maybe they may have, for example, a child who has Down syndrome. They might have three kids. How are we going to deal with it in Canada? We say, oh, Mr. X and Mrs. X, they're wonderful people, and look, like all the money they're making, they're paying all these taxes in Canada, and, you know, the kids have been going to school here for 3 or 4 years, and they've integrated well, and they speak English or French. Oh, but they have a child who has Down syndrome. How are we going to treat these people? So this is where the humanitarian and sometimes the economic aspects mix. So because we have humanitarian policies, and I want to be very clear about this, that, for example, we have spouses who can sponsor their spouses to come to Canada, which is largely a humanitarian regime. In Canada, we do have a same-sex civil society, and therefore these things occur. And so the question becomes, well, what if I have a spouse who has a medical condition? The most common one, let me be frank, has been HIV and AIDS. And so Canada's decided that we're not going to disentitle somebody because they have this kind of a disease who is the spouse of that person from coming to Canada. And it, by the way, it's not just same-sex couples. People say, oh, my God. Mr. Martinello is talking in the voice of Catholic radio about same-sex couples. Well, we don't bury our head in the sand here. Even the Pope doesn't. If you really want to read what the Pope says, you can read. There's all kinds of Vatican publications, and there's the dogma. But the Pope actually expresses a very humanitarian aspect towards people and towards these issues. And in this case, some of you may think that Canada is too generous, but that is the legal system right now. And we've seen, believe it or not, same-sex, not just same-sex, but in fact heterosexual couples who have this problem. So you may have a man, I'll use the example, married to a woman who, for a number of reasons, could be drug use, could be prior sexual habits, whatever it is, and they're married, but she has HIV unbeknownst to the other spouse, although maybe he's not HIV positive, and then what are you going to do? Are you going to deny this person entry? It becomes a very, the moral dilemma becomes great, and Canada has decided to do that. So Canada has become a bit more generous, and as I mentioned in the other case, somebody who has a work permit coming to Canada to apply for land and immigrant status who has a child, perhaps, you know. See, when people, we all talk in generalities, you know, and we say, oh, this is no good, that's no good. And then when you see the individual case, you realize how the law impacts the individual case. And then we start thinking maybe a little bit differently. We think, oh, you know what? If Joe Blow has a spouse and this and that, and, you know, it's really bad. Well, you know, we know now that there's a lot of medication that can control the situation. We know that there are families who, in fact, they can actually have children and not pass HIV along to their children. They're going to say, what are you talking about? One of the things that I perhaps have mentioned more in Italian radio, but I'll mention it here because I don't believe I ever mentioned it to me here on the English language broadcast. I have my cousin, who is a Salesian priest, who actually runs in Thailand and has for about 25 years a hospital, hospice, farm operation, which started initially for abandoned women and children who were HIV positive. Because at that time in Thailand, the government didn't want to do anything. They had their head in the sand. And my cousin was very instrumental, I will say that, to establishing this center, to getting funding, to getting, and he's a nurse by training, to getting antivirus drugs, oftentimes in the black market. It's no big deal. Everybody in the world knows that. To help these people out, that was a humanitarian aspect. And from 25 years ago and now, we have people who, of course, are still living and controlling that virus. And a lot of these people who were younger children, who are now older in Thailand, do the normal thing that people do, that is, they form a relationship. And the question also becomes, how, if you want to have a family, which is natural, you don't, you know, you want to avoid risks and so on and so forth. So the medicine and science has had huge discoveries, which now allow couples, one of whom are who may be HIV positive, in fact, to give birth to a child who is not HIV positive. This is also happening in Africa. It's true that all these things are happening, and it's a wonderful thing because it's pro-life. And I think that is the aspect that we have to think about. So here in Canada, perhaps we're more generous than some of us might think towards this kind of a policy, but the barrier has been limited, has been increased to a figure that's, like I said, it's $21,000 now. So so we want people to come, and we don't want to create maybe huge barriers, but we don't also want to burden our own healthcare system. And that's a political decision that's been made, and that's whether, and people will have to see if they think that is a good idea, and if immigration is such an important issue in the context of all the issues we have in elections, that they want to either support or not support the present party or other parties that may be more liberal. I like the NDP is more to the left, or the Conservative Party, which is more to the right. And so this is going to be a hot button topic, in my opinion. There's going to be a lot of talk about these things, and we're going to have to, as the old biblical expression is, separate the wheat from the chaff. We're going to have a frank discussion in our coffee shops, in our families, in our circle of friends, about what is the reality and what is not, and what people have different points of view. Because what we have to realize that in a civil society that we live in, reasonable people can have reasonable differences of opinion. Some of you might think, oh, Joe Martinello, he's more of a left-wing kind of guy or whatever. I don't think that's true. I don't like those kinds of epithets. I think, you know, they're banal generalizations. And my father always said he hated generalizations, and I hate generalizations. But there are people who still, you know, that's how they sort of synthesize a situation. But I have many of my friends who are not left-wing. They may be more right-wing, or maybe some of them are more left-wing than I am. But you can have a frank discussion about the pros and the cons about any situation like immigration. But the first thing is knowledge, and this is what we're doing in this program. We try to give people some knowledge to be able to have a rational discussion, no matter what our decision may be. And this is going to happen here. And so it's good to know that our immigration system is partly federal and partly provincial, because legally we have that system that has the great input of provinces. So things happen in Ontario for some reasons that are not the same as happen in other provinces, where they have different economies and different priorities. But we do have an overwhelmingly federal system that is not what we call the provincial nominee system. And all medical and security and criminal standards are federal. So I want everybody to understand this. It's really important. Even if the province of Ontario wants to have a certain program that favors whatever, we'll call them electricians or whatever it is, they cannot just bring everybody in if they don't have the proper criminal, they don't meet our standards of law on criminal, security, and health standards. So that is a national standard. It's not a provincial standard. It's a national standard. Passports are national. The visa is not issued by the province of Ontario. The visa to come to Canada is issued by the government of Canada, but there's tremendous input from all the provinces. And in Quebec, so people know, there's something called the Certificat de Sélection Provinciale. That's a provincial selection certificate. It's sort of the rubber stamp, the approval that the federal government gives, the Quebec government gives the federal government, who then issues the landed immigrant visa in English and in French, which are our official languages. So I mentioned Richard's article, and he talked about all these issues in some detail, not too complicated. It was very readable. And so when we hear about people arriving, we have to realize a lot of them are already here. So we're regularizing. And if we look at the situation in the U.S., which we say right now, what would we do? And that's a good question to ask all of ourselves. You know, because we can be pro-Trump, anti-Trump, you know, we can be whatever we want for different reasons. But at the end of the day, what would you as an individual, what would I as an individual do if I had the power to deal with over 800,000 people, 800,000 people in Canada, let's say, in this case, the United States, who came to this country maybe as a young age, who've gone to school here, who speak English and French or French, and maybe don't even speak the language of the country from whence they came, as they say in England. And what are we going to do with 800 people, the DACAs they call them? That's the short form. What are we going to do with 800,000 people? Are we going to send them back to Mexico, to El Salvador, to Honduras, after we've invested so much public money, time, and energy? If they're people that meet the security and health probably and criminality background, is there truly a great harm, except from an intellectual exercise of saying these people were here legally, or their parents were, so the sins of the father and the mother are therefore to be visited upon the children? That is the kind of discussion that we have to have in terms of our civil society. And this is the great challenge of the United States. 800,000 people, even if Canada is one not the same size, it would be 80,000 here. There'd be still a lot of people. What would we do here? How do we handle these people? Well, I can tell you what we would do here in Canada, because we have something called the humanitarian compassionate category. Now, it's not as humanitarian as compassionate as we used to be 15, 20, 30 years ago. I started practicing 40 years ago. We're not so humanitarian compassionate today. It's a very tough case. But I would bet the house on this one, that if we had young people who spoke English, who basically, or French, who, you know, had grown up here and it had been here for 15, 20 years, we're not going to send them back to wherever they came. They're pretty much well integrated. They've gone to school here. If they kept their noses clean and they haven't been involved in serious criminal conduct, probably we can be a little bit generous. Now, I know my friends in the Italian, the Portuguese, in the French communities are going to be after me on this one. They're going to say, Joe, you as a lawyer, you know, you say these things. But, you know, I cannot bring my brother from Portugal because, you know, he doesn't fit into all the boxes. And like you say, Canada chooses who comes here. And these people here, they've been here for so many years, and yet they're jumping the queue in the line. They're jumping the line to become landed immigrants of Canada. You know what? It's a very tough dilemma. I understand that. And there is no easy answer. Quite frankly, you know, if my Portuguese friend says that his brother can't come from the Azores because of the situation, I have sympathy for him. But in the context of the draconian choice, if I have somebody who's already here and well integrated, I think he's going to be able to be well established here in Canada, probably a bit better than the person who comes from overseas who's never really lived here. It's a tough decision. I don't want to play God on it, and I understand the argument. And those are the kinds of discussions that people need to have and say, okay, are we going to be humanitarian or not? You know, the Catholic Church led by the Pope would probably be more humanitarian than less humanitarian. And that even within the Catholic Church. If you read what is printed and so on, you'll see that there is a lot of discussion. And there are a lot of cardinals who don't agree with the Pope. And this dialectic, as I call it, this discussion has to happen, because you have to encourage, I always tell people, the true meaning of Catholic is really mean that you accept everybody. So, you know, there are people going to have different points of view, and there'll be more or less. But in the area of immigration, it's true, the Catholic Church is a little bit, a lot more, I would say, humanitarian and a lot more open to people who are in genuine need to coming to Canada as opposed to economic means. And this sometimes is not something that, for example, the Italian state appreciates, because the Vatican in particular, led by the Pope, is a great moral force. These are not the Middle Ages or the Renaissance anymore, where the Vatican or the Papal States had great armies of people and they did all the nasty things that all kinds of governments do and fight wars. It's not a temporal power anymore, quite frankly. But the moral force, the suasion that they have is still huge because there's about 1.8 billion Roman Catholics in this world. And the philosophy of the Catholic Church, which is in the New Testament and has been developed over years, is basically espoused by the Pope. And it is very humanitarian. I mean, we have to say it's more humanitarian than not. And so you will see, but that is the dialectic. That's the discussion that happens. And there's not everybody who thinks that way, even within the church. Doesn't make it right or wrong, but we have to understand that there are these things occurring. So I just wanted to report that, so in addition to the parental, grandparental thing, the numbers being increased, the issue relating to the dollar figure on medical refusals of immigration cases. I wanted to say that in 2019, we just had our, and because most of the system is based on the economic immigration platform, we just had the first entry draw into, with 3,900 invitations, and this is what we call the comprehensive ranking system or the CARS score, and it was as low as 449, which is actually a much lower figure. And so we're going to see how this, the figure is always in the same range, but the system has been working fairly well. And I'm going to devote a program into Express Entry again in English because it's not going away. It's going to be more important. There are a lot of people who, even if they're listening to us and they're not here, they may have nephews or nieces abroad who would be interested in coming to Canada. And this is going to be the key to people coming to Canada and so on. And Express Entry is a system. It bears repetition. So, but I'm going to give you an example because I'm talking a little bit about the humanitarian aspect of things. And I'll explain to you, I'm going to give you some case studies that talk about people who come here and what they do and how they're successful. And I'll just use one to let you understand. I'm going to call him John Smith, that famous John Smith. In English, there must be millions of John Smiths, so we use his name. So my example in this case is John Smith has been the senior accountant at a corporation in Ottawa for 2 years. He's the president of the corporation. He also happens to own 90% of the shares. You're going to say, Joe, you're talking about business class. What people don't realize is that just because you have money doesn't mean it's very easy to come to Canada. It's another urban myth. It's true. We've had the investor program. It's been used in the past. It's been considerably scaled back. All the provinces are using it much, much less. And it's almost a program that has such a small number, it's not in great favor. But active businesses or people who can establish jobs for Canadians are being favored, not somebody who just has money. This is something that some people outside of Canada, with whom I've had the pleasure of meeting, figure, well, I've got $5 million. I should be able to come here and live in Canada. I'm not going to be a burden on them. And I always tell them, well, you know, actually, Canada doesn't want you just because you have money. I say, what are you talking about? And they say, well, that's not the way the system is here. We want people who can invest and create jobs for Canadians. So it's under business to understand that the business immigration section, although it's a small one, is of that level. So in my example here, this to bring this point home, let's say that this gentleman came to Canada. He was what they call an owner-operator, labor market impact assessment-based work permit. And I must tell you, this used to be, and it still is, not a very easy category to get into. So let's just say that this John Smith is what he is. Let's say that John Smith is also single. And let's say that John Smith is 45 years old. He had 10 years' experience as a senior accountant in Portugal. He had a bachelor's degree in Portugal, and because he's been here for a few years, I mean, his English is great. He's done the CELPIP, as we call it, English language test for Canada, and he got the top marks. He got 12. Now, what's interesting on this system, with this comprehensive ranking system, the CRS, which enables him to get in the lineup to make the application, is that without including his Canadian work experience, he would have gotten a 381 score. And when you may have just heard what I just said, that they just had the latest draw and the number was as low as 449, you would say, wait a minute, Joe, you said 449 is the comprehensive ranking system. And this gentleman, which seems like a really good person, my God, he has all these qualifications. He only gets 381. That's correct. But when John includes his 2 years of work experience, he scores 459 points. You can see how important work experience becomes in the comprehensive ranking system. Get an invitation to apply for an immigration visa where you still have to hit the magic number, which is now 67 points. So let's say that John also has his T4, which is, you know, people who work, confirming his employment, an employment letter confirming his hours of work, his salary and his duties, signed by his brother, who happens to be the company's chief financial officer and a director. And John actually doesn't feel he's self-employed because he's got to always talk to his brother about what he's doing. But John would have held, in his category, would have had a 531 point thing without the experience. So you can see in this kind of situation that situation barely has worked. And you might say to me, Joe, I don't understand. Why would a gentleman like that be just on the cusp of it? And it's largely because of his age, because he's 45 years old. Because believe it or not, you start losing points when you get into your late 30s. So the system prefers people who are younger. Also, if he had a spouse who perhaps had a degree, another aspect of integration, would have got some points. Having a brother here would be good. So all these things, I just tell you that it's like a moving puzzle all the time that we deal with people. This week, as a matter of fact, we got two people from the Gulf, one of whom had actually come to Canada, and he wants to come to Canada now and stay because he's tired of living in a country that has no democracy, and you can make money, but you're not secure. And so he wants to come to Canada. And in both cases, they want to come to Canada. And this is the great discussion with them via the internet because they were here 15 and 20 years ago when the system was very different. And now they really don't know what they did or doing. They go online, they get hopelessly confused. And so what I wanted to point out, closing in an example that I chose like this, that it is not easy. Some people feel that they can do everything themselves. And, you know, for those of us who are so astute and so intelligent, that wouldn't include myself, that I can do everything myself, you know, you can try to do it yourself, but you probably have a lot of problems. It's a very difficult system to navigate. And on that point, although I wanted to dedicate more time to it, I will tell you that the only people who are authorized and to apply for and act for people who want to come to Canada and do this kind of work because they provide legal advice. But you have all kinds of people who pretend to know everything. Or as a taxi cab driver once told me, coming back from the airport when I saw his little business card, and it said something like something or other immigration services. And I said, the immigration services, the taxi cab driver. He says, oh, yeah, of course, he says. I do the immigration consulting business. Of course, I said, oh, you must be a smart guy. How did you ever do that? He said, I immigrated to Canada, didn't I? So that's the guideline. So, you know, if you can go to the pharmacy and get yourself aspirin, you're a doctor. And if you immigrated to Canada, you can be an immigration consultant. Why? Because the only people who are authorized to provide legal advice in this country, and in particular in the area of immigration law, are licensed and registered lawyers and immigration consultants in good standing. which everybody is on the list. And if you deal with people who are not like that, I wish you good luck, but it's illegal. They shouldn't be doing it. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of cases as recently as 2 weeks ago of a young lady that I knew who twice now has gone with people who are unregistered, and they've stolen thousands of dollars from her, essentially, and she has nobody to turn to because they did nothing for her. So on that happy note, use an immigration lawyer or immigration consultant that is expert in the area. All the law societies have them online. And use someone that will act in your best interest or in your family's best interest. And at the point today, I'm going to close the segment for today. Thank you for all listening. And we hope the program has been a benefit to you. And it's back to Nick in the studio of Radio Maria.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.